You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, thanks so much for doing this.
Nice to see you. If it's
our maiden voyage on Blogging Heads as a dialogue couple, so we'll see how this goes. I'm Harold Pollack. I'm a professor at the University of Chicago, and I'm here to talk to my friend, largely internet friend, but also occasional IRL friend, Wildfish. So why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm David Perry, and I'm an academic advisor in the history department at the University of Minnesota. I was a professor in the Chicago area for 10 years, so I'm a medieval historian by training, and I did that for a decade, but then I've really become a journalist, and then I have to... Journalism doesn't pay the bills. That may be a surprise to some people, but... So I work as an academic advisor as well.
And I should say, you and I have a number of policy connections. One being that we both write quite a bit about disability policy, and we also have some personal connections to disability issues that those of us who follow us on Twitter have seen before, and those who read your pieces in the Pacific Standard. Where else have you published recently? Where can people find you?
Pacific Standard is really what I'm focusing on. Pacific Standard is a West Coast magazine. It focuses on justice issues, and I'm a columnist there writing about 6 or 7 columns a month, depending on length. So that's really what I'm doing. I have been a freelancer for 5 years, and my work's been all over the place. But I'm really this year, I'm trying to shift from thinking like a freelancer and putting my work everywhere to thinking like a columnist and trying to build some infrastructure and some readership. Although I have been in The Nation, and I wrote a pretty goofy but fun piece for Salon just a couple days ago. And I was on NBC News just last week. So when editors reach out to me or I have something weird that doesn't fit my column, I have homes for them. But mostly I'm really focusing on Pacific Standard.
It is actually a very significant challenge for those of us who are academics to figure out how to make the right kind of long-term presence and to build a consistent audience and to combine our voice as academics with our voice in other modes that we write at and to do that in a way that we can feel good about, that we're operating with integrity and some kind of sense of coherence across the different types of work that we do. In some ways, maybe it's easier for you because a lot of your professional writing is actually about medieval history and things that are not immediately in the policy fray. I don't know whether you find that there's a crossover between your historical writing and some of the more immediate policy writing that you do.
Well, I have to say that the amount of journalism and public commentary that I do on medieval history always surprises me. I think, like a lot of people, I have a son, as people who know my writing know, with Down syndrome. He's 11. I also have a daughter who's 8, who does not have Down syndrome. But my son, when he was born, I did what a lot of academics would do, is I read for really 5 or 6 years. I just read a lot, and then I started doing a little writing, and I wanted to write about parenting and write about Down syndrome. But it turns out that medieval history enters the news cycle all the time, from mass media, Game of Thrones, but also the history of anything to do with the Catholic Church, the use of medieval symbols from modern white supremacists. Just this morning, there was a news item about a group of people who, during 2016, tried to bomb some Somali mosques and apartments in Kansas City, and they called themselves the Crusaders. And that's exactly the kind of thing I write about. So it's always been overlapping. For me, one of the real keys is unlike you, I was a teaching professor at a teaching school and very happy to do it. But it did mean that I had very little pressure on me to publish in any particular kind of way. And I suspect that you have had quite a lot of pressure on you to write specific kinds of things that would count. That really was, I mean, I had a few, but it was really a very low publication threshold. I had a lot of pressure on me to teach and teach really well and teach a lot and do a lot of service. So for me, journalism or public commentary, it's really only in the last couple of years I've begun to think of what I do as journalism. But public commentary was something I could do during the semester. I could, if I had an hour free or I had 2 hours free, I could sit down, I could do some reading, I could think hard, I could write 1,000 words, as opposed to trying to write peer-reviewable, densely footnoted, highly specific academic prose, which is something that I would need, I need, you know, 6 or 7 hours to do in any one stretch. And that just wasn't happening with, one, my heavy teaching load job, and two, of course, my parenting and my life.
Yeah, how many courses did you teach a year as a teaching professor?
I mean, honestly, it was only, I say only, a 3-3 load, which is pretty reasonable. I have many friends who teach 4-4 or who are assigned to 4-4, but in order to make ends meet, end up teaching a couple summer courses or do some overload loads and end up teaching a lot more than that. But I had a 3-3 load, and I found it possible to give all of myself to my teaching while also having enough kind of space around to do certain kinds of writing, as did my colleagues. I was at Dominican University in the Chicago suburbs, and it was filled with dedicated teachers who were trying to figure out, well, I'm not going to be the professor my graduate advisor was. I'm not going to be an R1 professor writing, you know, a book every 4 years or three or four highly specialized reports every year, whatever it is that different fields do. But I'm going to do something. I am going to have enough time to continue to contribute and think and write and produce. And so it was actually a pretty great balance. And it was such a great balance that I wrote myself into a new career and quit. But that wasn't really the plan.
There, but just to give our listeners a sense of the comparison. So my normal teaching load, we have a quarter system. So I would normally teach 4 courses a year is my basic obligation, although I and many other professors at a place like the University of Chicago typically have grants that would buy out of at least one of those. So we would be teaching less than half of the total amount of classroom hours that you're describing, and often significantly less. Now, we do have obligations to raise money and other kinds of things. We work quite hard, although in a different way. You're really doing the real work. Most American college students are attending teaching universities and I hope are encountering people with the kind of dedication that you have to your craft. I must say it is fun to teach.
It is fun to teach. I'm missing it right now, though. I'm gonna get back in the classroom in the next year or two, in some ways, if you count all the teaching I did during grad school, I've been a teacher for 20 years, and this year I'm not. I am not missing grading. I'm not missing grading at all. So there is that.
Lack of exams in my office. Yeah. By the way, one thing I should also mention, and partly as a segue into our common interest in disabilities, that you and I used to live near each other in the Chicagoland area, and now you live in Minnesota. And my understanding is that the quality of services here in Illinois played a role in your sense of wanting to go to a place that had a more humane social service infrastructure. Is that an accurate assessment?
That is absolutely right. You know, and it's one of those things where it's not just about red states and blue states, although it is true that progressive states tend to have more robust disability services because they've created the tax base and invested in it. But Illinois is usually a very blue state, but it's not a fiscally solvent state. And, you know, at the end of the day, if there's just no money, there's just no money. But there's choices. Illinois is still deeply invested in large-scale institutional housing for adults with developmental, intellectual, and other forms of disabilities. They're complicated. There are still 7 of them, and they're huge, and they fund the economics of the towns that they're in, and there are lots of parents who still like them, and surely plenty of disabled people who also like them. But that is not the kind of independent. We are hoping for our son to give him the skills to maximize his independence and to have him grow up into a system that is geared to maximize and support his independence and his autonomy. And Minnesota's doing it, and it's doing it in lots of ways. And, you know, my wife is from here. I went to graduate school here. But we, So there are specific things why here and not other places that are sort of family oriented. And I do want to say, I think it's very important for academics to be able to make choices about their life and about their happiness, and that we get pulled into a work culture that says you follow the job no matter what, and you maximize your publishing output no matter what, and that's what goodness looks like. And I'm certainly not doing that. I feel incredibly lucky to not be doing that, to be able to make some other choices. And I'd like to see us try to shift that culture.
It is, but one of the facets of family caregiving, I should say my wife and I take care of her brother. He now lives in a group home. He lived with us for a couple of years, and he has something called Fragile X syndrome, which is the second most common genetically derived source of intellectual disability, quite different from Down syndrome in a lot of ways, but there's also similarities. And it is such a gut check on what you really value in your life and what kinds of trade-offs you really are willing to make. And I've made some of those trade-offs well, and I've made some of those trade-offs in a way that after the fact I'm a little uncomfortable with. And, you know, it forces you, and it's a real show don't tell about how do you balance your work and family. You know, I teach at the University of Chicago, which is a great university. I do not like living in Illinois because we have a lot of problems with services here that if I were to take a job at a less prestigious university in a different state, I might be able to manage in a different way. And that's something that my wife and I talk about a lot. It is, I must say it also, since I do public policy work, it is the view from both sides of the counter is incredibly important. And, sure. But you know, I do a lot of violence research. And when I talk about violence here in Chicago, I never have anyone in my audience, particularly at this point, know everybody's very jaded. I could give a talk to a group of people, maybe 500 people. I could tell a story about an 8-year-old who gets shot and everyone will be very sad. But people are basically pretty, they've heard it before. You know, they'll say, that's terrible. When I tell personal anecdotes about my brother-in-law, Vincent, it is not, I have to actually be careful because it is not unusual for someone in my audience to start to cry and to say, you're talking about my son. And the toll that we take on our neighbors, our community members, because we do not provide the kinds of supports that people need, is significant, and it's often one where people have no way to talk about it. And it's much better than it used to be. I must say, one of the great things, I don't know what your experience is like, our experience with everyday people is actually fantastic.
Yeah.
Like tough, when we walk past tough kids on the south side of Chicago, and Vincent looks unusual. He's very large and he looks very childlike, and it's pretty obvious that he has an intellectual disability. He'll like wave at the tough kids hanging out at the corner. And they'll always wave back, and somebody's like, oh, my aunt's a special education teacher. I have a cousin who's got an issue. I went to, it's a kid in my gym class with Down syndrome, especially among younger people. Everybody's gotten the memo. And I was very fearful when he moved in with us that we would just have really demeaning experiences with just people on the street. And that just never happens. Our demeaning experiences are with bureaucracy and with services that don't work the way they're supposed to. And of course they work better for us because we have a set of class tools that a lot of other families don't have.
And race tools and gender tools if it's you. I mean, I think like you, I've generally had most very positive experiences in most contexts. There are a few exceptions, but generally positive. Part of that, of course, is that my son is really fun to be around and is a fun guy and is cute and silly and has a lot of strong social skills that he maximizes. But, you know, I've thought a lot in the sort of back in the academic context. One of the first things I did is I started in fact, when I was doing my on-campus interviews for my job, my son was a month old and I immediately disclosed everything because I kind of felt, well, I need to see how they handle it. I need to see how the institution, these people I would be working with in these small departments, would respond. And everyone responded very well. When I wrote my first op-ed, it was during the 08 presidential campaign, and Sarah Palin had been nominated. And I was very frustrated about the way that both the left and the right were talking about her son Trigg, that he was only being discussed in the context of the abortion debate and not as a full human who was going to have a life and need services and need support and maximize his agency. I mean, all the things that I care about was just not in the conversation. And so I wrote about that, and I wrote a little bit about what our life was like with my son at the time, which involved just lots and lots of different kinds of therapies and doctors. And my dean saw it on a search and sent it to the provost and to the president, and they wrote me, and they immediately gave me support, and I felt very safe. I know many female colleagues, both at my institution, though not so much at my institution because it was founded by nuns and is very nurturing, but more broadly in academia, who would never have felt safe, and rightly so, talking about their childcare obligations, talking about the amount of time they spent in a given week on their kids. And of course, I know the data, right? There's underlying the anecdote, there's data. There's the mommy penalty and the daddy bonus, that becoming a white male father does better in the workplace and women do worse. And
so. It's coded as an ambiguous commitment or an ambivalent commitment to the core professional activities of your work when you're a woman, in a way that is different. I must say my colleagues have been, very supportive of me as well. And Vincent, actually, we had to pull him out of a group home within the last month because he was actually assaulted and he's now fine, but he was living at home with us for a while and he was I was doing conference calls and he was sitting with me and he would occasionally pipe in with, a long, boring conference call, a random interjection always improves it. But, yeah. I'm very blessed to be in an environment where that is support. But I also, just going to the Palin thing, I remember your writing on that. I think that may have been when you and I first when I became aware of some of your writing. I was very positive about Palin when she was first announced. And when this issue came up, by the way, many people, in a disgusting way, there were rumors that she was covering up for her daughter's pregnancy, and politics brings out the worst in people in so many ways. I was really hoping that she would become an advocate for the issues that people with disabilities face. And there are many, this is not an issue that is disfigured by partisanship as much as most others. And there's, if you look at the history of intellectual disability and who's made great contributions, you see people like Bob Dole and George Will and lots of people who lived the life. And I don't agree with all of the policy positions that they had, and the issue and the abortion debate, of course, is a particularly difficult one in this context. In Sarah Palin's case, she was governor of a state that had significant problems. She never did anything to try to improve disability services, and then she became kind of a caricature of herself and sort of a pre-Trumpian kind of figure.
Yeah.
And it was a real opportunity lost, and I feel bad for her, actually, because I think she had a real opportunity to do something substantial and worthy that she would have earned a kind of respect that she never was able to earn in the way that she chose to differentiate her political product after that.
Right, right. I mean, I don't feel bad for her in the sense that I feel she made conscious decisions in order to be rewarded financially and that they took her in this direction. But, you know, the person who embodies what you're talking about is Kathy McMorris Rogers, who is a congresswoman from Washington State, has a son, I think just a month or two younger than my son, Cole, with Down syndrome. I haven't met the congresswoman, although I've talked to her. I've gotten quotes from her through her chief of staff from time to time, or her communications people, but I've never actually spoken to her. And we disagree about whether the state should assert control over the reproductive choices of others, which is to say I'm pro-choice and she's not. But I think we agree on a lot of other things. And, she did in this recent House vote in favor of reducing the power of the Americans with Disabilities Act, H.R. 620, which we could certainly talk about. It was passed by the Republican majority with a little bit of Democratic help, but also with some Republican dissent, and she came out against it, and she voted against it, even though I can't tell you the Down syndrome community is super active on commercial access elements of the ADA, because although there are people with Down syndrome who use wheelchairs, but it's not, and the commercial access isn't just wheelchairs, but I can't say my community has been very great on those issues, but she did vote against it. And that's, you know, I don't expect Republicans who are disabled or who are closely connected to people disabled to agree with me on everything, but I do expect them to think hard about their own identities and about the identities of the people connected to them and try to make sound decisions. And I expect that of Democrats, too. And we could certainly spend some time talking about how Democrats fail on those grounds, including...
Democrats fail on those grounds, as you see it.
Well, I mean, first of all, there were Democrats in the House who voted against. So this bill, for those who don't know it, H.R. 620, it basically gives 180 days for any business to make progress on any access issue. So right now, if you have an access issue and you go into a business and it's not accessible, you can sue them. Then that's the chief enforcement mechanism for the ADA in terms of private business. And it's a little more complicated than that. And you can't sue them for damages. Because there are a few, and it's really a handful of unscrupulous lawyers who have taken advantage of this, basically hiring disabled people to go into businesses to find failures of compliance with the ADA, although the failures are genuine, and it's almost 30 years old, there's now this attempt to push back the ability 180 days. And what it does is it just removes incentives. And some Democrats voted for it, and Democrats have voted for it in various states. It is the law. There is a notifications bill in California passed by progressive majorities, backed by hotel lobbies and restaurant lobbies and shopping mall lobbies. So, you know, Democrats are willing to sell out to business interests, and I'm sorry that they did. But one of the things that you and I have talked about a lot, of course, is the rhetoric around mental health. They're sort of in two modes right now. One of them is the continued attempt to use kind of mental health stigma as a tool against President Trump, which boy do I get. I understand why people want to go this way. I mean, everyone should be really troubled by his behavior and his personal behavior. But also gun violence, which I've written about a lot, that, you know, progressives generally do want to regulate access to firearms in various kinds of ways, but they are sympathetic to mental health issues. And no matter how many times we pull up, we being the disability community broadly, and really led by people who themselves identify as mentally ill, pull up statistics saying, no, people with mental illness are most likely to be victims, not violent themselves. Every time there's a mass shooting, mental health leads the way. So those are two of the places where I think progressives, well, I mean, there's no reason to expect progressives not to be affected by ableism as they're affected by racism and sexism and classism. I mean, we have oppressive ideologies. They're people. They're going to consume those ideologies. I just want progressives to try harder to resist them.
But let's discuss those sequentially. So if we start with President Trump, I think it is certainly true he has many behaviors that are a mark of bad character. That should just be discussed as, you know, he is bullying, he is impulsive, he is lazy, he demeans other people. Those are not mental health challenges in and of themselves. Those are behaviors that reflect poorly on his character as a person. I must say that what makes me somewhat ambivalent, some of his behaviors remind me of how people sometimes behave when they have poorly managed mental illnesses. There isn't a completely firm line. I mean, that lead people to have failures of self-regulation. But I do think in general that to try to politically leverage the stigma of mental illness is the sin. this, right. You know, the sin is not to say he may have these characteristics that are, sometimes go with mental illness. It's that we are trying to diminish him and damage him politically by the association, as opposed to saying you are a bad person.
That's exactly that. I mean, there's a bunch of pieces. That's absolutely part of it, is the attempt to say, if you'll excuse me, he's crazy. That's why you shouldn't vote for him. So that happened during the election. I wrote about it then. And I've written about a lot of hot button issues, but that's the one that I've gotten in some ways the most hostility from my community. You know, when I write about abortion, I certainly get plenty of people very mad at me or gun control. But that was the issue in which the attacks from the left were, and which I care about much more. When people who are anti-choice get mad at me, I sort of, you know, I either shrug it off or I block people or whatever it is. But it's fine. It's when I'm trying to work with my own community. But the other thing is to me, there's kind of a, I think progressives, we want a quick fix. This is a disaster. So once he was inaugurated, it moved from kind of the stigma and hopes of diminishing him to these dreams of the 25th Amendment, these dreams that somehow, you know, his own cabinet was going to turn on him because he had mental illness or he had dementia or something like that. And, I mean, first of all, I don't know to what extent Mike Pence is an improvement. He might be less likely to launch a nuclear weapon via tweet, which does count for something. But that's a side debate. I just think it's not realistic. There's no feasible possibility in which the 25th Amendment is invoked against Trump, except if some kind of neurological event happens that is so significant that it would be invoked. Any president could have a stroke and be unable to function and have the 25th Amendment go into effect. That's what it's there for. And I'm glad it's there. I just, I think there's a fantasy that we're going to beat Trump through impeachment or beat Trump through the 25th Amendment. We're going to beat Trump, if at all, through politics, normal politics.
I certainly agree with that. Let me make a couple comments on that. Ezra Klein had an interesting column about impeachment where he notes one reason we're so focused on the mental illness dementia issue and the 25th Amendment is the guy's obviously unfit for office. Yeah. I mean, there is a sense that, I mean, he does not function properly. If he were the dean of my school, he would have been removed for the kinds of behaviors that he's engaged in. He's just comprehensively unfit for this job. We don't have a way to talk about that and to act on that, except through the 25th Amendment when it's between terms. And the idea that he did XYZ, he is not qualified for the job, he is lying, he is doing all these things that are deeply destructive, and he's managing the government into a shambles. We have no way to deal with that. So we say, well, there's a common sense way where a lot of people say, hey, let's go to the 25th Amendment, because that's how we conceptualize someone being unfit for office, as opposed to let's look at everything he's doing and how messed up it is. And, you know, if he were CEO of Exxon, he would not be the CEO of Exxon much longer, and so on. Yeah. Now, by the way, the other aspect, the other aspect that's kind of interesting is how would we talk about a president who really did have either a mental health issue, was not neurotypical, or in some way had a real issue, or was just old and had issues of mental infirmity or whatever it is. As a society, we don't know how to talk about that in an open way. We have all of these senators who are quite old, some of whom are clearly affected by infirmities of age. And we don't know how to talk about that in a straight up way. And I think it'd be really interesting if we actually had a frank conversation. Like let's say that somebody ran who's 78 years old, and he's obviously got something in it. He's got some very valuable and appealing qualities that makes him competitive to be president, but he's 78. We don't know how to say to this person, you know, you're 78. What's your plan for how you're going to manage, or maybe you're forgetful. You're incredibly charismatic. You have all sorts of great qualities of in engaging policymakers. But we can also see that you are somewhat forgetful, maybe more forgetful than you used to be. How are you going to manage that as president? Or maybe someone who was on the autism spectrum, and you say, okay, how are you going to manage being chief executive, given that this is an issue for you? And we don't know how to talk about that in a straight up way. I don't know if you've thought about that.
I would like to see us talk about it the way we should talk about it in all contexts, the language of accommodation. And reasonableness. So if I think we could totally have a president with memory issues as long as they had a good note-taking system. I think we could have I hope someday we have presidents who are deaf or who are blind we've already had presidents in a wheelchair, although it's significant that FDR tried to conceal his physical condition. But, you know, I can imagine someone running. I just been writing about the Gallaudet Deaf President Now protest 30 years ago this month. So I've been thinking about deaf president for the United States, right? Yes, you would have people say, well, how are you going to be president without the phone? And we'd say, well, the same way you talk on the phone now if you're deaf. You use a relay or an interpreter or a video call, right? So I'd like us to have accommodation. And the 25th Amendment is, in fact, built in a way, probably by accident. I'm not an expert in its crafting, but built in a way that supports that. The 25th Amendment doesn't say you have to be neurotypical to be president. It says you have to be able to fulfill the functions of duties, just like anyone with a disability needs to be able to fulfill the functions of their job with reasonable accommodations. So that's the language that I would like to bring in. What kind of accommodations does each person need in order to fulfill the functions of their task, including being commander in chief, including being president of the United States, and are those accommodations reasonable? Of course, instead we have a society in which to even raise that creates an attack point. So in politics, so instead we have closeting behavior, we have concealment and closeting and stigma, and that that doesn't do any good for anybody. It certainly doesn't advance the cause of disability rights or disability justice.
It doesn't allow for someone to actually function well. You could imagine someone, for example, who doesn't – I mean, I was thinking about a president sitting in a meeting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he's not maintaining eye contact, and he's rocking back and forth, and he's fidgeting. And then at some moment he says, hey, wait a minute, you told me that group of soldiers in Afghanistan, that they were going to be in this place, because he's got that attention to detail. And he's functioning well. It's just that he's not interacting with people in the way that they expect in the superficiality of it. And we all certainly in academia, that would not be an unfamiliar, thing. Now, one thing that you mentioned when you talked about mental illness and criminal justice, which is an issue that I work on quite a bit, one of the fundamental challenges is to distinguish dangerousness from mental illness and different types of mental illness and the issues that are there. People who are angry and impulsive, particularly when there's a substance use involved, those are the people that you tend to see violence from. And now there's a suicide risk, of course, when people have major depression, and there's a whole issue about how we think about weapons in the hands of people who might harm themselves that of course is significant. Uncomplicated mental illness, when it doesn't have that substance use component, and it doesn't have that angry and impulsive behavioral component, those are people who are not dangerous. And they're people who are, as you said, are often victims and who may require all sorts of assistance to be successful members of the community. But they are not people that we need to be scared of. We do have this problem that because of the proliferation of guns, we are desperate, desperate, desperate to identify those dangerous people, because everyone basically has the right to have a gun unless you specifically check off a very small checklist for dangerousness. And then you can see how we are driven to the false hope that there's some sort of a mental health diagnosis that will lead us to identify people. Most of the time when someone commits an atrocity, after the fact, there's always red flags after the fact. Boy, you look at those, they look a hell of a lot redder after the thing's over.
It's it's easy to connect the dots when you know there are dots. I mean, that's I have a friend, Bruce Schneier, who's a security writer, who started to talk about that after 9/11, that once you know that there are dots, it's easy to connect them, but ahead of time, you don't know there are dots. Yeah.
And the biggest, the most readily connected dots are often not about mental illness, but about other things. I do think that I would like to see us make some changes in gun policy that could help. I think one is, one of the real problems we have with young adults is they don't have enough of a track record for us to understand what's going on. A lot of people who become dangerous, they really flower in whatever their symptoms are of their life challenges when they're 19, 20 years old. And then where they can legally go buy a gun. And if we had a minimum age that was like 25 for legal purchase, you just have more years to see what's going on with that person. And many of these folks, they would have been more likely to have been prohibited purchasers at a later age. And we also have to think about, I mean, the gun violence restraining order, there's some potential there for some, at least when there's a red flag that says, while we're figuring out what's going on, let's make sure this person doesn't have a weapon. I don't know what we can do about, say, the AR-15 problem, that it's such a lethal thing. And
we have to ban it. I mean, we have to ban it. But I understand the politics are very difficult to achieve that. But I just don't. I think we can have a free society without people owning semi-automatic rifles, let alone semi-automatic rifles modified to fully automatic rifles.
If we required everyone to satisfy the kinds of standards that hunters satisfy to get hunters' licenses, actually, I suspect that this problem would be, there are steps we could take that do not require an outright ban that would help.
There was someone, I wrote a piece about the Second Amendment recently, just pointing out that, in fact, a well-regulated militia is not necessary for a free state, and that the Second Amendment's based on a false premise. But someone yelled at me on Twitter that, oh, yeah, well, we don't take away cars just because someone else is in an accident. And I said, I would love to treat guns the way we treat cars. That's a great idea. Let's do that. Yeah.
I think many gun owners would actually...
I think the majority, yeah.
Okay, so...
Let's go back to mental illness stuff. So So first of all, I want to recommend, there was a piece in The Nation by S.E. Smith, who I think is the best writer on the best journalist on disability issues in America, and also a real advocate for getting more people into, more disabled writers into journalism. Basically, an S.E. Smith who identifies as mentally ill said, you know, the big problem with mental illness and guns is suicide, as you say. So if we want to talk about that, we can talk about that. But it's not about – murder is not the big problem. My feeling, though, about all of these kinds of issues is that we – and by we, I mean myself as a writer who cares about disability, but hopefully you and hopefully anyone else who cares about it, we have to – not say, we have to not give the other side, well, yeah, no, we should talk about mental health too, but we have to decouple these conversations, because otherwise stigma wins. And one of the places that's similar to me is around the question of filicide, which is to say the murder of disabled children by their parents, and caregivers and sometimes by their children, but especially parents murdering their children, which is a thing that happens almost every week. Something I've written about a lot, something that the autistic self-advocate community has really led the way on. And whenever that happens, one response is, oh boy, they must have needed more support, those parents. And they may have needed more support. Sometimes that's true. I think you'll have a hard time finding someone more passionate about supports for people like me. I am a parent. I want support. But we have to, in that moment of responding to murder, we have to decouple the conversation. We cannot allow the conversations to exist next to each other. And I think the same thing is true around mass violence and mental health, that, yes, sometimes there is a clear diagnosable, retroactive diagnosable kind of red flag we can point to, but that we have to work very hard to decouple those conversations. Legislatively, in Minnesota, like many states, they're just passing a law, they're passing school safety laws to try to make them harder targets, but also including things like mental health care. And I'm all for more mental health support in our schools. I think more mental health support in our schools is a big deal. I'm afraid that when coupled to issues of school shootings, it will be used coercively. It will be used in ways that magnify stigma. It will be used against children of color. It'll be children who are non-cis and non-heterosexuals, children who are more poor, that these, instead of creating a network of mental health support, which I'm in favor of, we will get networks of mental health surveillance that will be used against the vulnerable.
And virtually assured because, for one thing, if you count the number of school shootings in the United States in a given year, it's maybe 50, 75. There's 140,000 schools in America, some number like that. And you can, there's absolutely no question in my mind that more lives will be lost and more tragedies will occur because of what happens in those 139,950 schools where there's no school shooting than anything that happens in the response to the rampage shooter, as a result of whatever policy is being pursued. Yeah. That seems fairly obvious once you stop to think about it that arming, whether it's arming teachers or you know, a whole variety of other policies, that, you know, we're talking about 50 people in the United States that go on a rampage, and we're going to do something that affects literally millions of kids.
And those 50 people matter, and those deaths matter, and we could go after the guns, and as opposed to, I mean, that's again, I think a lot about who my audience is, as a writer and as a speaker and as a tweeter. And sometimes I'm trying to persuade people, and sometimes I'm trying to sketch out what an argument, a persuasive argument might look like in case someone else uses it. But you know, this is a place where I'm trying to persuade progressives. I'm trying to persuade people who basically agree with me, but who still knee-jerk react to talk about mental health after a shooting like Parkland, as opposed to, and I want us, you know, sort of allies, like-minded people, to think about, no, let's tease apart these conversations. Let's not put mental health and school shooting next to each other. Let's talk about mental health 364 other days, but on this day, let's not do it. Let's not give in to that temptation. And, you know, that includes Barack Obama, who I'm basically a fan of in many ways. You know, I'll never be a fan of any president 100%, but I think he was by and large a very good president. And, but he talked about mental health. Joe Biden talks about mental health. Bernie Sanders talks about mental health, in these contexts. So before I feel I can try to persuade hardcore NRA supporters, I need to persuade my brothers and sisters. I need to, you know, and I think about those kinds of, who is my audience? I'm often writing about disability in ways that the hardcore radical disability community already knows this. But they're not my audience. My audience are other white suburban parents of kids with disabilities who don't know yet, but would like to. Yeah. Right. Or brothers-in-laws. And I always say, one of the lines I say a lot is, and if I'm the first person who's ever said this to you, don't let me be the last. I'm hoping to have an kind of an interlocutor function. And that's tricky, and I'm sure I get it better sometimes than others. But I always think it's worth sort of pausing and realizing that you need different arguments to do different kinds of things and pay real attention to that.
You know, what's one thing when you mentioned the filicide issue, one of the real educations for me was talking with people in the autism self-advocacy community, which I've done some. I could do a lot more. I have a lot of the intellectual disability conversation is centered around the family caregiver and the parent and the and others in the family. And one of the things that the autism self-advocacy community in particular has really brought to the table in a powerful way is, hey, wait a minute. You know, we have agency. Others, people with disability have agency. And I had Ari Naiman, my friend, and I, and Sam Bagenstas have been doing work together. And when we talk about things like the sheltered workshop issue, it is a different perspective. You know, as a family member, in a lot of ways, the deficiencies of the sheltered workshop are much less pressing on me than they are on the person who's actually going and doing it every day. And because one of the things you worry about so much as a family member is my family member going to have a place to go where they're going to be safe, where I can go to my job, where all of these functions that the sheltered workshop is implicitly doing that make my life possible that may not have makes any sense at all in terms of the individual developing their role in the community. I'm convinced my brother-in-law, if he were 30 years younger, he would be at a job in the general community with a whole set of skills and opportunities that he does not have now because he's spent his entire life within the context of the sheltered workshop system. And one of the ironies being, for example, there's this function that they have to be doing work. A lot of the work that they're doing is very repetitive work that doesn't really generate that much output and that doesn't generate any skills. And in some ways I'm thinking, why is he doing that? Why don't they just have him working out or doing some kind of other activity that's not a workshop? That's just a developmental activity. But because because of this framing, he's in the workshop, he's doing this essentially make work a lot of the time. And I totally honor a lot of the good things that are being done there if they were done in a way that was explicitly acknowledged and discussed in terms of his well-being and our needs as a family without the overlay of, in a more frank way and in a way that where he has more say over what he does. I don't think he particularly enjoys loading things into bins all day long when there's nothing going on.
Right. I would like to say something intelligent that builds on that, but I fully agree, and it's one of my long-term concerns to my son. I don't care if he works. I don't care if he contributes to the capitalist value of American society. I think that in the disability rights world, there is too much focus on work and jobs as an assertion of value. I mean, again, I in fact think work and jobs are really important, and I think that the efforts being done to create real work is incredibly important. It's not that often when, including in the abortion debate, the anti-choice side will point to people with Down syndrome who work as a symbol of the value of their lives, and I just don't care. I think the autistic self-advocacy community has done a good job on this, both focusing on work, but also there's a Twitter writer, Eb, E-B-T-H-E-N, Eb Then, who has just a must-read feed on all kinds of disability justice issues. And they talk all the time about, capitalism will not save us. Capitalism, work will not lead to, this focus on producing value through work will not lead to disability justice. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have. Doesn't mean it isn't important, but it can't be the end of the whole thing. Yeah,
it's a way of understanding and communicating that people are valued, worthy contributors to our communities, and it becomes and it's perfectly. I think it's an important part of the conversation.
Absolutely,
but it does become. It obviously becomes problematic. I must say, one thing we should also talk about is the role of the disability community in helping to rescue health insurance for millions and millions of Americans, and the fight over Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act. And
right now, today, for I think 10 or 11 days, this is the 19th of March. 10 or 11 days, this the same people who helped save Medicaid and Medicare are camped out in D.C. trying to stop the electric shock torture, or I agree that we could call it torture, but to convince the FDA to release regulations banning the use of electric shock aversives, but pain-based aversive for autistic children and adults. And this has been going on for years, and we think the regulations have been written, but just not finalized. And so ADAPT, this group is I'm glad to mention that are currently camped out on day 11 trying to convince the FDA to to release these regulations. So, you know, the disability community has at least a 50-year history of direct action of different kinds of sorts, dating back to the late 60s, really famously in 1977, the longest sit-in of a federal building in U.S. history, in order to again, get regulations released for Section 504 of the 1973 Rehab Act. You don't need to go there, but there is a, you know, trying to, it's often these pretty kinds of things. But there's a long history of direct action. And so when Medicaid, when it looked like Medicaid was going to be really, really ended as a functional program, we saw what happened last summer. And the disability community was ready for it, right? That wasn't spontaneous. It wasn't accidental. It was heroic, but not kind of spur of the moment heroic. It was planned and practiced, and they were ready for it. And I hope that story gets told. I hope it gets told for a long time as we think about kind of how change happens and how change doesn't happen.
Well, it's also striking how the disability community emerges as an absolute pillar partner in progressive politics. And the combination of people living with disabilities and the people connected to people living with disabilities. And it turns out not only advocating for themselves and their families, but also advocating for everyone and saying, you know, healthcare is a right. We live it every day because we use wheelchairs or we require various kinds of services that we have a very immediate need for. But we are not advocating merely for ourselves. We are advocating for a society where no one has that vulnerability. And it is, what's interesting is within the health reform community, there has always been an ambivalence about the disability component that is rarely discussed. People, when you go to expand health coverage, people who advocate single payer or people who advocate universal coverage, there is a real desire to say we could have a cheaper healthcare system that would make so much more sense if we all, you know, get rid of the private insurers and we, you know, look at how much less people spend in Western Europe than in the United States. It just makes so much more sense for us to have universal coverage. Many of those arguments, by the way, I identify with.
Yeah.
The disability community comes in a very different way. First of all, they say, hey, we have some concrete needs that are not being met and that are expensive. And don't tell us we're going to save money. What we need is we have some concrete needs that we want to see met. And it's also complicated and intricate. Like, people want to talk about Section 504. They want to talk about what are the nursing home regulations. And very often, progressives who want to expand health coverage, they don't want that complexity to be foregrounded. Because one of the big selling points is it's not a radical thing. It would be so much simpler if everyone could just be on Medicare. Let's not talk about how Medicare actually functions if you might have to go into a nursing home and get all complicated on us, because that kind of muddies the message. And there's been a under the surface, there has been a real tension about which claims to really foreground and how much do we really get into the nuts and bolts of health policy that people with disabilities need. I'm hoping that as we look ahead to 2020, that people in the disability community can say, hey, you know, we were the people that to a great extent defeated efforts to repeal ACA. So we're not expecting that the entire health policy debate is going to be dominated by disability in our next go-around. But we are expecting that we should have a seat at the table. And, you know, that $2,000 asset limit, if you're on SSI and you're disabled and you can't have more than $2,000 in countable financial assets, we want that dealt with. You know, there's some things we want to have that are concrete. And maybe your younger folks who are showing up at some of the rallies who don't conceive of themselves as disabled, they may require some education about these issues. But, okay, so let's do that. And I think it's going to be really interesting seeing, now that the disability community has really earned a central place at the table, what folks do with that and how the entire progressive health policy world accommodates that. Because I think it has to be more than in the case of ACA. I think it really has to be, some concrete stuff has to be offered and taken up and progress has to be made.
I'm pretty optimistic about that. I mean, there's plenty of work to be done in the disability community itself, which has been dominated by white men, has been dominated by people with limited physical disabilities, certainly over intellectual disabilities. I mean, there's plenty of problems within the movement itself. Right now, there are big debates about disability rights versus disability justice, and there are always people pushing
in between those.
Well, I don't really want to speak. I mean, I think people should go read the work of Talila Lewis, who heads a group called HERD that works on incarceration and deafness and policing in particular. But focusing on whether you've got kind of a rights-based approach in which you say, well, these people have these legal rights, and that's the key, or whether you're looking for justice, which is about equality and about a world in which there's less violence and less oppression. So it's harder, but more meaningful. But also, I mean, I definitely think there are people in the disability community who are a little bitter that they've done all this work for so long and people only paid attention during Medicaid. I mean, it's complicated. The slogan Medicare for All is a great slogan. The slogan Medicare plus expanded Medicaid, making sure you have long-term supports and services for all, is not as good a slogan. You have to use a much smaller font for the bumper sticker. But I do think that conversation's happening. One of the places I've seen it happening is at the Center for American Progress, that hired Rebecca Coakley, who for a long time was the executive director of the National Council on Disability, which is a federal advisory board, now works for them. They've been doing work on disability for a long time at the center. And they put out a big set of policy documents. I think they called it Medicare Plus. And forgive me if you see this, Rebecca, and I got your title wrong. But it was very clearly trying to say, what would it look like to do Medicare for All but address the needs? And again, people are skeptical, as you say. I watched it happened in my Twitter feed. And I mentioned Twitter a lot. And it's not just casual. Twitter is, I think, the most accessible real-time conversation in human history. Because many people with many different access needs, not all, find Twitter accessible in ways that other forms are not. So you can be deaf, you can be blind, you can be nonverbal, you can have social issues where you don't want to go out in crowds. You can use voice to text typing. You can be anywhere in the world. You can be in your home. You can be unable to get out of your bed at a particular moment, whether because of reasons of lack of access to technology or because of chronic fatigue. Like, there's a hugely accessible ongoing conversation happening there. Anyway, a friend of mine, or a Twitter friend of mine named Alex Haggard, I think, from Canada, started talking to Americans about the limitations of Canadian socialized medicine for their health needs. And people basically just didn't want to believe it. I mean, I was watching it happen, that American progressives just, they know it would be better for more people to have a Canadian-style system here. So they just, it's like, shh, don't talk about your problems. But, you know, this is often literally life and death, or at least, you know, accessible, being able to have access to the world or not. So I do think that's happening, but it is happening slowly. On the flip side, there are lots of disabled people who voted for Donald Trump. The numbers I saw were about 46% of people who identify as disabled and about 48% of people who identify as a caregiver or family member of someone who is disabled. That's not shocking. Certainly that it's a demographic that skews white and skews male and skews all the way the broader. What?
Unrelated to the age structure of who voted for Trump.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I would like to politicize 7% of those people around disability. I think that, you know, that they're kind of gettable, and they're gettable without betraying other core values. That, you know, people say, well, let's appeal to Trump voters by not being so pro-choice. I'm kind of not willing to do that. But I think there's a group of people who just don't think about the ways in which disability policy affects their lives, but that it does. And if we can reach just some of those people, around sort of around the edges, it's the kind of thing that starts building a margin of victory that looks pretty comfortable.
Well, I absolutely believe that, and I've said that to candidates too. That imagine that you want to go out to rural Wisconsin, just to give a totally random thing, and you want to talk to people in an honest way that is human, that is consistent with your values and their values, and build a connection to those people who might be culturally, religiously, might seem distant from Barack Obama, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who are really concerned about direct healthcare, access to direct healthcare services, who have a parent in a nursing home, and who are also economically very concerned about the impact on their community. You know, if you cut Medicaid, a rural hospital is like, when you close a rural hospital, that is like a gigantic plant closing. And, you know, in a lot of these areas, you just count up the jobs that people have, the number of people who have jobs connected to the care for people with disabilities, people who themselves have health caregiver obligations or need care. That is something that brings people together in a very genuine way that cuts through an awful lot of the polarization that disfigures everything else in American politics. And I remember when I was doing Get Out the Vote in Iowa, I talked to a woman who was pro-life in her self-description and was pretty conservative, and she was going to vote for President Obama because she was really worried about family members that needed nursing home care, and she felt that President Obama could be trusted more than Mitt Romney could be trusted about things that were needed in Medicaid to keep that nursing home healthy. And it's I think that is rural America is one place. There's many other places where those issues are very, very real, both in terms of people's lives, in terms of people's pocketbooks, and in terms of local economic development, that is very consistent with what you're saying.
And if it turns out that we successfully politicize disability in such areas, it'll mean that Republicans come back to supporting disability rights and disability access. I mean, which certainly historically, disability-related legislation tends to pass with wide bipartisan majorities. And you know, that might make it harder to win elections by kicking the other team, but it might lead to more good policy and more support for things I care about. And I'm kind of willing to take that. I mean, I see that a little bit in local politics in Minnesota, where, you know, there's a lot of the things I care about, in fact, have broad bipartisan support. Well, that means it's not useful as a way to win an election, but it's useful in a way to make people's lives better. And in the end, that's what really matters.
I certainly agree with that. And I do think, by the way, a lot of the same governors who reject Medicaid expansion and so they were working with the Obama administration on disability. And I think, by the way, that people, I think many people who criticize Democrats seem to believe that we go into these communities and like want to lecture people about intersectionality or something like that, you know, and have them apologize for being heterosexual or whatever the, And actually, a lot of the people who identify as kind of resistance are doing this kind of work, and they're basically saying, let's listen to people and figure out what's important to them, and then say, well, okay, so what is it that the Democrats and the Republicans are offering that really addresses these key issues for you? And if the Republicans decide, hey, they're going to compete by giving better value for people living with disabilities, that would be great.
I mean, totally. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's like the way the system is supposed to work. So speaking of the system supposed to work, I think you're supposed to work at 3 o'clock to meet.
I'm supposed to go off to my next task.
So, thank you so much for piloting me through this, my maiden voyage here. I really enjoyed talking to you and getting some new Twitter tips, and I hope that we can talk again.
I look forward to it.
Great.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.